Good afternoon and welcome to Washington Today for Tuesday, November 24th, 2020. I'm Bill Scanlon. With the presidential transition process now officially underway, President-elect Joe Biden today introduced the core of his national security team, which includes the return of former Secretary of State John Kerry in a new role. That story and others after a quick look at headlines. Pennsylvania and Nevada today certified their vote in the 2020 presidential election. Last night in Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed the certificates of ascertainment, recognizing a slate of Michigan electors for President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. In COVID news, Johns Hopkins University reported today that the average daily COVID mortality rate in the U.S. is now 1,498 deaths per day, the highest since May 14th, and it appears to be increasing exponentially. Wall Street Journal story this afternoon says the CDC is considering reducing the recommended quarantine time to ensure someone is COVID negative from 14 to 7 to 10 days. They write that CDC sources say it's intended to encourage more people to comply with the measure. And the Atlantic hurricane season is ending, having set a record. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration seasonal hurricane outlooks accurately predicted a high likelihood of an above-normal season, NOAA reporting that the 2020 season produced 30 named storms, of which 13 became hurricanes, including six major hurricanes. This is the most storms on record, surpassing the 28 from 2005. President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris today presented some of the members of their national security team in the upcoming administration, including introducing Anthony Blinken for Secretary of State, Alejandro Mayorkas as Secretary of Homeland Security, Avril Haines, Director of National Intelligence, Linda Thomas-Greenfield for U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor, and naming former Secretary of State John Kerry as the special presidential envoy for climate, who will sit on the National Security Council. At the Queen Theater in Wilmington, Delaware today, Joe Biden said the U.S. cannot meet challenges it's facing with, quote, old thinking and unchanged habits.
It's a team that will keep our country and our people safe and secure. And it's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, once again sit at the head of the table, ready to confront our adversaries and not reject our allies, ready to stand up for our values. In fact, in calls from world leaders that I've had, about 18 of them or 20 so far, I'm not sure the exact number, in the week since we won the election, I've been struck by how much they're looking forward to the United States reasserting its historic role as a global leader, both in the Pacific as well as the Atlantic, all across the world. The team meets this moment, this team behind me. They embody my core beliefs that America is strongest when it works with its allies. Collectively, this team has secured some of the most defining national security and diplomatic achievements in recent memory, made possible through decades of experience working with our partners. That's how we truly keep America safe, without engaging in needless military conflicts and our adversaries in check and terrorists at bay. And that's how we counter terrorism and extremism, control this pandemic and future ones, deal with the climate crisis, nuclear proliferation, cyber threats and emerging technologies that spread authoritarianism, and so much more. And while this team has unmatched experience and accomplishments, they also reflect the idea that we cannot meet these challenges with old thinking and unchanged habits. For example, we're going to have the first woman lead the intelligence community, the first Latino, an immigrant, to lead the Department of Homeland Security, and a groundbreaking diplomat at the United Nations. We're going to have a principal on the National Security Council whose full-time job is to fight climate change. For the first time ever, that will occur. And my national security team will be coordinated by one of the youngest national security advisors in decades. Experience and leadership, fresh thinking and perspective, and an unrelenting belief in the promise of America.
Joe Biden, from his opening today, introducing his national security team. Avril Haines served as deputy national security director during the Obama administration and as deputy director of the CIA. If approved by the Senate, she would be the first woman to become director of national intelligence.
Mr. President-elect, You know that I have never shied away from speaking truth to power. And that will be my charge as Director of National Intelligence. I've worked for you for a long time, and I accept this nomination knowing that you would never want me to do otherwise, and that you value the perspective of the intelligence community, and that you will do so even when what I have to say may be inconvenient or difficult, and I assure you there will be those times. And finally, to our intelligence professionals, the work you do, oftentimes under the most austere conditions imaginable, is just indispensable. It will become even more complex because you will be critical to helping this administration position itself not only against threats such as cyber attacks or terrorism and the proliferation of nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons, but also those challenges that will define the next generation, from climate change to pandemics and corruption. And it would be the honor of a lifetime to be able to work alongside you once again to take these challenges on together.
That's Biden DNI designee Avril Haines. A Biden administration will raise the issue of climate change to a cabinet-level concern. Former Secretary of State John Kerry was named as special envoy on climate. He talked about the U.S. rejoining the Paris Climate Accord.
Mr. President-elect, you've put forward a bold, transformative climate plan. But you've also underscored that no country alone can solve this challenge. Even the United States, for all of our industrial strength, is responsible for only 13% of global emissions. To end this crisis, the whole world must come together. You're right to rejoin Paris on day one, and you're right to recognize that Paris alone is not enough. At the global meeting in Glasgow, 1 year from now, all nations must raise ambition together, or we will all fail together. And failure is not an option.
And on the presidential transition, news reports have been saying that Joe Biden will start receiving the White House presidential daily briefing. The president-elect was asked about that late this afternoon.
It's been offered. I did not have it today. We're going to do it on a regular basis. The certification, or what you call the they've been very forthcoming, offering all access, and so we're going to be starting those on a regular basis.
Why didn't you announce your-
And some Republican reaction to the president-elect's picks from Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio, who sits on the Foreign Relations Committee. He tweeted this morning, Biden's cabinet picks went to Ivy League schools, have strong resumes, attend all the right conferences, and will be polite and orderly caretakers of America's decline. I support American greatness, and I have no interest in returning to the, quote, normal that left us dependent on China. That from Marco Rubio. In election result news today, Pennsylvania and Nevada today certified their state results in the 2020 presidential election. In signing Pennsylvania's ascertainment certificate, Governor Tom Wolf said, today's certification is a testament to the incredible efforts of our local and state election officials who worked tirelessly to ensure Pennsylvania had a free, fair, and accurate process that reflects the will of the voters. Joe Biden is leading in Pennsylvania by over 80,000 votes. Nevada Secretary of State Barbara Zagofsky presented the Silver State's final results today before that state's Supreme Court.
A record number of voters cast a ballot in Nevada this year. The final tally was 1,407,754. When measured as a percentage of active registered voters, it was 77.26% voted. Four counties had turnout that was over 85%. And as usual, Douglas County has the highest turnout, Elko, Esmeralda, and Eureka. The county with the lowest turnout this year was Mineral County, still an impressive 74.3% turnout. Voter registration efforts offered new challenges due to the pandemic, yet Nevada still gained 357,045 new active registered voters for the 2020 general when compared to the 2016 election, bringing the number of registered voters across the state to 1,821,864, a total increase of 24.3% in active voters. The resulting breakdown of ballots cast was 49.2 by mail ballot, 40.98 during early voting, and 9.73 voting on election day. I'd like to thank all of Nevada's election officials for their dedication and commitment to providing a transparent, legal, and fair election. And I'd also like to thank your staff and for assisting me and my staff putting this together today. And I'd like to thank my staff as well for everything that they've done.
That's Nevada Secretary of State Barbara Sigafsky. Joe Biden won Nevada by over 33,000 votes. The House and Senate are out this week for the Thanksgiving holiday, but they're holding pro forma sessions every few days. Today in the House, Chaplain Father Pat Conroy opened the session in prayer, beseeching some assistance and guidance during the presidential transition period.
Give to us and all people a vivid sense of your presence, that we may learn to understand each other, to respect each other, to work with each other, and to live with each other, and to do good to each other. So shall we make our nation great in goodness and good in its greatness. Bless those involved with the transition process of the executive branch. We thank you that once again, we are showing the world the benefits of peaceful transition with changes in power and leadership.
Late Monday, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, announced that she would not seek to retain her leadership in the next Congress, saying that, quote, I look forward to continuing to serve as a senior Democrat on the Judiciary, Intelligence, Appropriations, and Rules Committees as we work with the Biden administration. Covering the story for HuffPost is Sanjana Karanth. This move by Dianne Feinstein, not entirely unexpected. What were some of the forces at work that may have helped her with her decision?
Hi, right. So basically, Feinstein's, her statement, notably, when she was announcing that she was intending to step down after the legislative session from her post, the reason she gave was that she wanted to focus more on her state of California and how climate change is impacting it through the wildfires and droughts. So notably, the senator did not mention in her statement anything about what actually likely led to her stepping down, which is, as most of us can probably guess, her handling of the Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett's Senate confirmation hearings back in October. You know, Coney Barrett was viewed as an extremely conservative justice, and Democrats were preparing to play hardball. But Feinstein kind of essentially undermined that plan by handling Coney Barrett with kid gloves. She was telling her she's impressed with her answers, which, as everyone who watched the hearings know, Coney Barrett didn't really answer anything. And she also kind of undermined other Democrats by being very extremely warm to Chairman Lindsey Graham, who had already broken his promise of not pushing through a Supreme Court justice nominee on an election year. She even hugged him on camera. Her compliments to him about how he handled the hearings likely helped Republicans, especially Graham, who was up for re-election in a tight race against Jamie Harrison in South Carolina.
How quickly after the hearings were over do you think the progressive groups were pressuring Democratic Senator Schumer, the Democratic leader, to make some changes on judiciary, or at least to talk to Dianne Feinstein about that?
I think it was pretty soon, actually, after her. I think her warmness toward Lindsey Graham was maybe the tipping point. I know many progressives were already kind of upset with her behavior during the hearings, but the congratulating of Republicans for such a hearing really pushed a lot of progressives to ask Schumer to give her what Schumer called a long and serious talk. And it's, you know, a month after that, and she has announced that she's stepping down.
Well, the senator was criticized, as you pointed out, for this hearing, but she's also was criticized for the way that she participated in the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings a couple of years ago. Why is this leadership position, the Democratic leadership position in the Judiciary Committee, so important?
This leadership position is extremely important, especially going into the Biden administration, because as we've seen throughout Trump's administration, we have seen a ton of court confirmations, not just the Supreme Court, but federal courts all over the country. And having the Senate be controlled by the GOP means that a lot of these judicial nominees get confirmed to lifetime appointments. And so it's incredibly important for Democrats on this committee to play hardball and to say that we need to put a stop to this. Which, as you mentioned, Dick Durbin is kind of in the running for this, and he has expressed in his announcement that he plans to play hardball about those court confirmations.
How do you think those progressive groups who are critical of Dianne Feinstein view Dick Durbin, and might there be other challenges for that ranking Democrat position?
I'm not sure about how many others are challenging it. I know Senator Whitehouse is kind of next in seniority. But what progressives, I think, are more concerned about right now is the overall tradition of using seniority in order to determine leadership. I know that at least the Sunrise Movement, who has been a climate organization, they've already been very critical of Dianne Feinstein's, opinion on the Green New Deal and how she handled a lot of youth climate activists demanding she vote yes on it. They have said that, you know, not only do they want Feinstein to resign, but they would also want Chuck Schumer to be able to kind of reevaluate the whole tradition of people who are senior to just automatically get a leadership position instead of the people who maybe they view as more qualified.
One more thing. Senator Feinstein is 87 years old, and she's the second longest serving senator. How much do you think age played into her decision not to lead the committee up for the Democrats?
I do think there was maybe some influence on that. I think especially as a lot of progressives, maybe without particularly saying that age is a big factor. I think a lot of people were saying that because she is 87, she's been in there for so long that, you know, it's kind of watered down her ability to play that hardball against people she's also worked with on the other side of the aisle for so long. And I think it's important to note that, you know, it's not that she's leaving Congress right now. It's just that she's leaving that leadership position and plans to not seek other leadership positions. But that does not mean that she is not a senior Democrat who will still be pushing for the issues she's finding important.
Sanjana Karanth covers news and politics in the nation's capital for HuffPost, and you can follow her reporting on Twitter at Sanjana Karanth. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And at the White House today at midday, President Trump made a very brief appearance in the press briefing room to tout a booming stock market and more positive news on the vaccine front from several vaccine developers.
Well, thank you very much. And I just want to congratulate everybody. The stock market, Dow Jones Industrial Average, just hit 30,000, which is the highest in history. We've never broken 30,000. And that's just despite everything that's taken place with the pandemic. I'm very thrilled with what's happened on the vaccine front. That's been absolutely incredible. It's nothing like that has ever happened medically. And I think people are acknowledging that. And it's having a big effect. But the stock market's just broken 30,000. Never been broken, that number. That's a sacred number, 30,000. Nobody thought they'd ever see it. That's the ninth time since the beginning of 2020. And it's the 48th time that we've broken records during the Trump administration. And I just want to congratulate all the people within the administration that work so hard. And most importantly, I want to congratulate the people of our country, because there are no people like you. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
And the president had reason to note those Wall Street numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rallied today, breaking above 30,000 for the first time. CNBC reporting the 30-stock Dow surged 454.97 points, or 1.5%, to close at 30,046.24. Amid positive vaccine news, hope for a strong economic recovery in 2021, and easing of political uncertainty as the Trump administration approved the start of the presidential transition. A record day for the the S&P 500 as well, climbing 1.6%, and the NASDAQ composite advancing 1.3%. You're listening to Washington Today for Tuesday, November 24, 2020. It is Washington Today for Tuesday, November 24, 2020. As more positive results come out from several COVID vaccine developers, the co-leaders of Operation Warp Speed, the Trump administration's COVID vaccine production and distribution program, Army General Gus Perna and HHS Secretary Alex Azar, gave reporters an update this morning. General Perna said that the federal government will be able to distribute vaccine within 24 hours of FDA's emergency use approval. General Perna was asked about his prediction of being able to distribute 40 million doses by the end of 2020.
Hi, this is Carl O'Donnell from Reuters. You mentioned that you had given some guidance to the states in terms of the general size of the initial allocation of vaccine that they're going to get to help them prepare. Do you have a national figure at this point for the amount of vaccine, you know, that'll be distributed overall to the different states and jurisdictions? And what is that figure? And are you confident that we'll still get to the 40 million figure overall by the end of the year?
So, yes, I do feel confident that we're going to get to close as we can to 40 million at the end of the year. I mean, snap the chalk line, what exactly comes off, we'll know at the end. But I do feel confident, and we've planned scenarios to that end, and we've worked with the jurisdictions for the total amount through December. The initial amount, as we were speculating on when EUA would come out, because we're not involved in that process, literally on the whiteboard, we're trying to figure out when that decision might be made. I finally made the decision Friday night, late Friday night, to snap the chalk line so states could prioritize based on amount. That amount that we allocated to the country was 6.4 million doses of vaccine. And then what will happen if there's more available after the initial push, then it will go out in the following weekly cadences of distribution accordingly. But yes, 40 million by the end of the year.
Next question is Dan Bergano, BuzzFeed News.
Thanks very much. I'm wondering if you have any concern that the general population will be disappointed when they figure out the prioritization is going on, that it's going to healthcare workers and nursing homes, that sort of thing, and not to sort of the general public until it sounds like months from now, months have been discussed, like April to June, thereabouts. If you had any guidance on that as well, that would be great. Thanks very much.
Well, Dan, we've been very transparent throughout for the American people and for you all about the timelines as we best understand them at each step of the way and potential prioritized groups. Of course, we have not announced recommended prioritization. We've talked about some core groups that make some fairly obvious sense, especially in light of the National Academy's input and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices focus. Those, of course, are those in nursing homes, as you mentioned, our most vulnerable citizens, our healthcare workers who are on the front lines, our first responders. Those are some of the broad groups we've talked about. And we've focused and we've said that we expect by the end of December to have enough vaccine to vaccinate those who are most vulnerable, just by way of sizing and scaling. That by the end of January, we think we would have enough to vaccinate our senior citizens as well as our healthcare workers and first responders. And then, as the general has talked about, progressively, week after week, just more vaccine keeps coming off of the production, gets quality controlled and released into the system, additional prioritized groups, or eventually just general vaccination availability, to the point that in the second quarter of next year, we believe we'd have enough vaccine from all sources to be able to make that so that anyone who wanted to get a vaccine in the United States would be able to get that. But that's a progression, a constant progression. And so we've been very clear for months, really, about that sequence. And that's the best we can do, is just to use forums like these and others to educate in that regard.
That is Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar. Just a quick programming note, Dr. Anthony Fauci will join us on Wednesday's Washington Journal tomorrow morning, 7:30 Eastern. In Des Moines today, Des Moines, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds outlined that state's vaccination strategy, eyeing the FDA vaccination approval timeline.
Whenever the decisions regarding approval are made and distribution begins, Iowa is ready. The Iowa Department of Public Health has developed a vaccination strategy in coordination with a wide range of public and private sector partners, including public health, emergency management agencies, healthcare organizations, industry groups that include critical infrastructure sectors, policymakers, and community vaccination providers. Iowa's vaccination strategy addresses allocation, distribution, transportation, dispensing, and administration of state-allocated COVID-19 vaccines. The strategy is based on the availability of the vaccines and the distribution occurring through existing infrastructure. At first, there will be limited supply of COVID-19 vaccine, so our immediate vaccination efforts will focus on those critical to the response, including those who provide direct care and maintain critical infrastructure, and those at highest risk for developing serious illness from the virus. Prioritization of populations while the vaccine supply is limited is being considered by the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices and the National Academy of Medicine. In addition to their recommendations, the Iowa Department of Public Health and Dr. Pedotti will also consider CDC guidelines and work with various stakeholders to implement a targeted approach for COVID-19 vaccination. Some details of the plan, of course, will be contingent upon additional information that won't be available until the FDA approves emergency authorization for vaccines. So those details include things like the number of doses that will be initially allocated to our state, which will guide prioritization of populations and the immunization requirements of the specific vaccine. Once those details are known, the Iowa Department of Public Health will finalize the strategy and prepare to begin distribution of the vaccine.
Governor Kim Reynolds of Iowa. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada said today Canada will have to wait for a vaccine because the very first ones that roll off the assembly lines are likely to be given to citizens of the country they are made in. He said that the United States, the United Kingdom, and Germany have mass vaccine production facilities, but Canada does not. He spoke today outside his home in Ottawa.
I think one of the things to remember is Canada no longer has any domestic production capacity for vaccines. We used to have it decades ago, but we no longer have it. Countries like the United States, Germany, and the UK do have domestic pharmaceutical facilities, which is why they're obviously going to prioritize helping their citizens first. So Canada did two things over the past months. First of all, we've begun to invest once again in ensuring that Canada will have domestic vaccine production capacity because we never want to be caught short again without the ability to support Canadians directly. And that will be in place in the coming years. If ever there is another pandemic, we will not be be caught on the wrong foot again. But secondly, that's why recognizing the challenges we had around getting vaccines from other countries to Canada, the Canadian government signed a record number of agreements with vaccine producers, potential vaccine producers around the world. We have reached out and have actually one of the very best vaccine portfolios of any country around the world, with far more doses for Canadians potentially than we actually have Canadian population. That's because we don't know which vaccines are going to be most effective, which ones are going to arrive early, but we have done everything we can to ensure that Canadians get these vaccines as quickly as possible and as effectively as possible. But of course, in all cases, we are in for, as a world, a number more months where we have to do everything to keep our cases down before vaccines get here so that we are able to get through this as best as possible, which is why people need to continue to stay safe and limit the spread of COVID-19.
Overseas, France will begin easing its COVID-19 lockdown this weekend so that by Christmas, shops, theaters, and cinemas will reopen and people will be able to spend the holiday with the rest of their family. French President Emmanuel Macron said today in a televised address to the nation that the worst of the second wave of the pandemic in France was over, but that restaurants, cafes, and bars would have to stay shut until January. From France 24, here's part of his speech.
A new stage will begin starting Saturday, 28 November, in the morning.
Il y a d'abord ce qui ne va pas changer.
First of all, things that will not change. Tailored lockdown, the system of certificates will remain in force because this has enabled us to reach these good results. Therefore, it would be necessary to continue to stay at home, to work from home when possible, to not go to family gatherings and private meetings and do any unnecessary traveling. But as from next Saturday morning, several changes are going to take place. Firstly, it will be possible to travel outside, and you'll be able to go within 20 kilometers for 3 hours for sports and other outside activities. Extramural activities will be possible as well. Houses of worship, it will be possible to worship the maximum gathering of 30 people. And lastly, I know what great expectations there are, and I know how important this is for our daily lives. The malls and city centers, all stores will be able to reopen and the home services will resume, but there will be a very strict health protocol which has been negotiated with all professionals that I would like to thank here. Services and businesses will be able to reopen, staying open until 9 p.m. at the latest. Bookstores, record stores, libraries, and archives will also be able to open in these same conditions. The second stage will be starting December 15th. On December 15th, if we do reach around 5,000 contaminations per day and around 2,500 to 3,000 people in intensive care units, then we will be able to move on to a next stage.
Across the channel in Great Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson confirmed on Monday that his country will end a month-long lockdown on December 2nd. The Prime Minister spoke to Parliament virtually.
The national restrictions in England will end on the 2nd of December, and they will not be renewed. From next Wednesday, people will be able to leave their home for any purpose and meet others in outdoor public spaces subject to the rule of six. Collective worship, weddings, and outdoor sports can resume, and shops, personal care, gyms, and the wider leisure sector can reopen. But without sensible precautions, we would risk the virus escalating into a winter or New Year surge. The incidence of the disease is, alas, still widespread in many areas. So we're not going to replace national measures with a free-for-all, the status quo anti-COVID. We're going to go back instead to a regional tiered approach, applying the toughest measures where COVID is most prevalent.
And here in the U.S., it may not be the typical Macy's Day parade this year, but we do have the traditional presidential pardoning of the turkey. President Trump thanked the medical and science professionals fighting the pandemic and military and law enforcement today in a White House Rose Garden ceremony.
Every American can be united in thanksgiving to God for the incredible gifts he has bestowed upon us, the blessings of family, community, and this exceptional, beautiful, and great country. It's greater than ever before. During this Thanksgiving, we extend our eternal gratitude to the doctors, nurses, healthcare workers, and scientists who have waged the battle against the China virus. And we give thanks for the vaccines and therapies that will soon end the pandemic. It's just such a tremendous feeling to know that they're coming, and they'll be coming probably starting next week or shortly thereafter. We send our love to every member of the armed forces and the law enforcement heroes risking their lives to keep America safe, to keep America great. And as I say, America first. Shouldn't go away from that. America first. We give thanks to the priceless freedoms that we've inherited, and we ask God to watch over and protect our nation and its people during this incredible holiday and in all of the years to come.
And after his brief remarks, President Trump, for the final time in his presidency, delivered the good news to this year's unplucked pear, Corn and Cob.
Corn, I hereby grant you a full pardon. Thank you, Corn. What a great.
David Dinkins, the first and so far the only black mayor of New York City, has died at the age of 93. He was on C-SPAN's Book TV in 2013 talking about his memoir, A Mayor's Life, Governing New York's Gorgeous Mosaic. He recalled how in 1989 he defeated then-incumbent mayor Ed Koch in the Democratic primary and Republican candidate Rudy Giuliani in the general election.
We had three opponents, the incumbent Ed Koch, Dick Ravitch, who had done a wonderful job with the MTA in its capital program, and Jay Golden, Harrison Jay Golden, who I say is one of the most articulate people I've ever encountered in municipal government. So we figured, or the pundits figured, that I could never prevail because even were I to finish at the top, I wouldn't get 40%, and my three opponents, each of whom was Jewish, would gang up on me, their supporters would, and I would lose. Well, we got 51%. And then I'm facing Rudy Giuliani in the general election. Keep in mind, Rudy is not yet America's mayor. 9/11 has not yet occurred. You figure with the Democratic enrollment over Republicans at least 5-1, and if I get 51%, granted it's a different electorate in a primary, that we would certainly win. Well, 1.9 million votes cast, and we won by a margin of about 50,000 votes, but we won.
That's the late New York City Mayor David Dinkins on Book TV in 2013 from C-SPAN's video library. Rudy Giuliani came back 4 years later in 1993 to beat David Dinkins in a rematch for the New York City mayor. Mr. Giuliani, now President Trump's personal attorney, he tweeted this late Monday night. I extend my deepest condolences to the family of Mayor David Dinkins and to the many New Yorkers who loved and supported him. He had a great deal of his life in service to our great city. That service is respected and honored by all. That'll about do it for Washington Today on this Tuesday, November 24th, 2020. We are back tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. Eastern, simulcasting C-SPAN's Washington Journal. If you missed any part of this episode, you can find it on the free C-SPAN radio app, or you can find it also to wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us today on Washington Today. We hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.